So lecture 12, October 10th, lecture notes page is 102. Used to be Columbus's Day, but that was not very culturally sensitive. Happy Indigenous Peoples Day, Monday, October 10th, celebrating the cultural heritage of the First Peoples. If you know anyone that's looking for work, graduating soon, an alumni of ours, Lexi Minot, is working for New Day USA, a national VA mortgage company that puts the American dream within reach for veterans. They're hiring across that set of positions with that level of detail. They seem legit, so if you know anybody that's looking for work, have them check that out. I told her to go to Handshake, so maybe it's in Handshake by now. I'm not sure, though. Networking for Good, Friday, October 22nd. I'm going to try to be there if I can. Test results, mini test 5 came in, average score 86%. Mini test 6 will open tomorrow. Now, as you know, did you guys hear that we have a fall break? Are you, you aware of that? How many people think that's a great idea? How many people think, meh? Nobody thinks meh. I'm with you. Meh.
Why is it the end of the week? It's only like one day off for
me. Well, there you go. You'd like to have my day off, my class off. Yeah, well, you know, you could write for off on that. Anyhow. Because there is that, and we're supposed to give you a little bit of a break, I'm going to make mini test 6, and it's been on the schedule this way, not due on Saturday during the break, but instead it'll be due Tuesday, so it gives you a couple days back at work to get it done. You could do it over break if you wanted to, but you don't have to, all right? So that's going to be forthcoming. Of course, you may have heard that midterm 1 is up and running. How many people have taken midterm 1? Not very many. Okay, well, tomorrow I'll be getting a bunch of messages, I guess. Enhanced Learning Extra Credit number 4 has been open. It closes Wednesday. How many people did research extra credit number 1? It's just a survey, I assume. Is that all they're doing? Just asking some questions? Simple enough? Yeah? All right, so get that done. Add 0.5 to your final course grade. So keep in mind, for those of you that haven't gotten around to taking midterm 1 yet, it closes tomorrow. It closes at 6 p.m. Webbies, 6 p.m. So don't be writing me and saying you think it was open until 11:59 p.m. It's been on the schedule. I've said it. It's been in the housekeeping slides. 6 p.m. tomorrow. I've got a lot of questions about... Yeah, it's open book, open notes. So you can have the physical book. You can have a copy of those notes. You can have your handwritten notes. Somebody wrote and said, is it okay if I see I can't have mini test questions and answers. Can I have review test questions and answers? No, it's the same thing. You can't have test questions and answers there. I have to rephrase that for everyone into the future. I just didn't think that way. So your notes, your definitions, your index cards, the lecture notes, anything that you use to study legitimately, do that. Anything you'd use to cheat, don't do that. How many people have seen I told you what your midterm grade as posted will be? Okay, I didn't get a lot of questions or issues from people, so I assume it's as you expected it to be. It's actually, since I didn't hear any complaints, issues, problems, it's uploaded. If you have a question on that, let me know, but it is what it should be. So this was sort of an interesting story for Business and News. I thought we were joking the other day about having a robot professor. Well, here's Walgreens using robots to fulfill prescriptions in order to free up their pharmacists. Inside of a large Walgreens facility in the Dallas area, bright yellow robotic arms fill thousands of prescriptions for customers who take medications to manage or treat high blood pressure, diabetes, or other conditions. Each robot can fill 300 prescriptions in an hour. The company said, roughly the same number that a typical Walgreens pharmacy with a handful of staff would do in a day. So we talk about the external factors that impact business and marketing. Here's technology impacting this particular business. Walgreens Boots Alliance is opening the automated centralized hubs to keep up in the fast-changing pharmacy industry. The pandemic has intensified the drugstore chain's need to stay relevant as online pharmacies siphon off sales and more customers have items from toilet paper to toothpaste delivered to their doorstep. The global health crisis has also heightened the demand for pharmacists because hospitals and drugstores hired them to administer COVID vaccines and tests, leaving less pharmacists to do pharmacy work like fulfilling prescriptions. So here we see a company doing business in the world of whitewater rapid change. And once again, throughout the entire system, the impact of the pandemic on consumers' behaviors, as well as a bit of competition. Our pharmacy, local pharmacy, is dealing with competition from online stores. By 2025, as much as half of Walgreens' prescription volume from stores can be filled by the automated robotic centers that will free up more pharmacist time to provide health care. We're doing all this work so the pharmacist has an easier job, so they can get back to being front and center, building a relationship with the patient and interacting the way they were trained, the work that they love to do. As more prescriptions get filled by robots, pharmacists can take on other duties that Walgreens can bill to insurers or customers, such as testing and treating medical conditions like strep or the flu, writing prescriptions for people at risk of HIV. So, presumably, this change is helping to provide value to consumers as the pharmacists can have relationships with them, build relationships with customers, and, by the way, as they can move to doing these other tasks, create additional revenue. After all, we are working at a profit. Pharmacists will continue to fill time-sensitive medications and controlled substances at local stores as the company expands the use of its robots. Great idea, robots, saves time, frees up time. Yeah, I like that. Horrible, just taking more people's jobs away from America and away from workers. We shouldn't be using robots for that. Nobody? Very liberal, one person, very liberal group here. Band-Aids and Tylenol will have a new name on their packages. We've all heard of Band-Aid, Tylenol, Benadryl, and Johnson's Baby Powder, but we've never heard of the new made-up word, Kenvue. But Kenvue will be the new corporate parrot of these familiar consumer health brands next year. So we're seeing a bit about corporate and brand management. Johnson & Johnson, the owner of these labels, is in the process of splitting into two companies, one focused on medical devices and medications, the other on consumer health products. Johnson & Johnson is keeping its recognizable name for its larger pharmaceutical business unit, but needed to come up with a new brand identity for the smaller consumer arm. So here we're seeing corporate growth strategies. We feel we'll get more value if we split one company into two. We're seeing brand strategy coming up with a new name for our customer side. The company landed on Kenvue, a combination of Ken, an English word for knowledge, primarily used in Scotland, and view, a reference to sight. It's pronounced Kenvue. The split is set to be completed next year. A J&J spokesperson said a small team worked with a creative naming agency to develop and screen thousands of names for the new company. J&J wanted a name that be distinctive, memorable, exactly the traits we're going to talk about when we get to the chapter on branding. This fits just too early in the course, exactly in with what we say a brand name should be. It also needed to clear trademarks in more than 100 markets. That took some time. And pass linguistic and cultural screening to make sure that Kenvue doesn't mean something you don't want it to mean in some language you weren't thinking about. Be a little awkward. In 89 languages and dialects. So, global marketing issues, brand name issues. It's no coincidence that Kenvue does not have any meaning or history, said Jay Juris, the CEO and creative director of brand naming at the agency. Companies often look for names that are squeaky clean from any controversy. The name Kenvue reflects J&J's desire for the new consumer company identity to take a back seat to the well-known brand such as Band-Aid. This is a similar strategy to other consumer product conglomerates such as Unilever, the owner of Dove, Hellman's, and Procter & Gamble, which owns Bounty and Sherman. We'll talk again about this when we get to the chapter on branding, but when you think Bounty, you don't necessarily think Procter & Gamble Bounty, right? You think Bounty. I don't know who owns it. Bounty is sort of a freestanding name. As opposed to, again, I'm getting ahead of myself, any product in the Armor All line, Armor All window cleaner, Armor All tire cleaner, Armor All seat cleaner, uses the company name rather than have a freestanding brand name. So they're different strategies. So Kenvue is really just a holding company behind all these other brands. They want a name that will disappear in the background, and the brands themselves, those brand names, will stick out. So their branding strategy. This is not the first time two words have been combined in a new company's name. In 2012, Kraft Foods split its food brands, such as Oreo, out into Mondelez. Mondelez, a combination of Monda, derived from the Latin word for world, and Deliz, short for Delicious, Mondelez. All right, so that's their branding strategy. Finally, Coors Light. Of those of you that are old enough to drink, anybody drink Coors Light? We have Coors Light fans? The back row. All right. And I won't ask what those of you that aren't old enough to drink are drinking. Coors Light wants to do your dirty laundry. So you can get back to watching college football on Saturday. Saturday is college football game day. But unfortunately for fans everywhere, it's also the most popular day of the week to do laundry and chores. So a bit of understanding consumer behavior here. As the beer made to chill, Coors Light believes chores shouldn't get in the way of game day. That's why this college football season, Coors Light will keep your chores light in a national partnership with Tide Cleaners. Coors Light will do your laundry so you can spend more time at the bar watching college football. So here we're seeing brand partnerships, Coors Light and Tide Cleaners, and providing consumer value. Football fans nationwide can enter to win free laundry services from Tide Cleaners and Coors Light merchandise and a Tide product bundle during the college football season through November 4th. Now, instead of spending an entire Saturday doing laundry, you can chill with a nice cool Coors Light and watch your favorite college football team. So this is called a sales promotion. We'll talk about it much later. It's a sales promotion in the marketing mix. And yesterday, in select markets, fans were able to ditch the to-do list and get back to watching, I guess it was 2 days ago, and get back to watching college football. They were able to simply drop laundry at a participating bar in Cincinnati, Denver, and Chicago, and it was then sent to a local Tide Cleaners location to be washed, dried, and returned to their doorsteps. For a chance to win $700 in credit for Tide Laundry Services, visit Coors Light Chores, CoorsLightChoresLight.com. So they're connecting with the consumer. To explain how the Chores Light program works, Coors tapped ESPN's College Game Day analyst and longtime Coors Light partner, Kirk Herbstreit, because he knows better than anyone that Saturdays are for college football, not for chores. So we're using a celebrity, a brand spokesperson, to get the word out.
Coors Light wants to keep your chores light. Enter now for a chance to win a whole season of free laundry services while you chill and watch the games.
Can Coors Light do my laundry too?
These are delicates, my man.
Just a bit of silliness. Another aspect to the Coors Light online sweepstakes involves a collection of first-party data. They don't have to worry about cookies. They don't have to worry about somebody else selling your information to them. You're opting in as you do the sweepstakes. You put in information for them to win the sweepstakes. They now have your data, much like other names in the consumer goods industry, from Clorox to Cheez-Its. The beer brand is seeking more information on its customers to better deliver targeted ads. So we're getting opt-in from consumer data. We have an ongoing strategy to collect people's first-party data, says Marcello Pascoa, VP of Marketing for Coors Family of Brands, who noted this strategy is present in the Coors Light Chores Light program. Ultimately, it's a tool to make sure the right message gets to the right people at the right time. So we have a strategy to reach our target audience with our brand message appropriately. All right? So pick up with lecture notes page 102, page 179 in the textbook. We've just gotten done with y'all disrespecting Patrick Lowe, the retired chief economist at the WTO. And so there was our visit. So based on what we heard the other day, how many countries are there in the world? We finally learned what the population of the U.S. is, more or less. How many countries are there in the world? Well, more than two, and that's not right. Webbies? Give me, yeah. 195. Our answer in 2017 was 196, unless you don't count Taiwan, which we don't. When you count Taiwan, China gets upset. So you're right, 195. So 196, but there are only 150 of those in the World Trade Organization, unless you don't count Taiwan. Taiwan is not considered an official country by many, which would bring the count down to 195, what you said. Although Taiwan operates as an independent country in many countries, including the U.S., although Taiwan operates as an independent country, many countries, including the U.S., do not officially recognize it as one because the People's Republic of China considers Taiwan a breakaway province of China. Countries that wish to maintain diplomatic relations with China have had to sever their formal relations with Taiwan. More than 100 countries, however, have unofficial relations with Taiwan. What's relevant in U.S. foreign relationships to this particular story that happened maybe a month ago? Anybody on board with what I'm talking about?
Hurricane Ian.
Say again?
Hurricane Ian.
No, not relevant to this, but thank you. Kind of, yeah. Pelosi decided why don't I visit South Korea? And why I'm there? Well, why don't I just drop in on Taiwan? We don't, of course, really know what goes on in the upper echelon of the upper levels of White House. Hi there, how you doing today? Upper levels of White House discussions, but what's with that? You're just looking to jerk off, upset the Chinese. Okay, fine, whatever. So that just happened recently. Second trend, rise of economic, or trend two, continuing rise of economic integration, things like the EU. 27 countries with more than 440 million consumers as of Britain's exit in 2020. All these countries used to be separate economic and political entities. Imagine how difficult it was to work within Europe in business, for trade, for customs, for visas, for passports, for moving your goods across those 27 countries to do business. This has made life a heck of a lot easier for people and, of course, for organizations as well. So it operates an internal or a single market, which allows the free movement of goods, capital, services, and people between its member states, making one big market. But you have to be in the EU to benefit from this. This is what Pat Lowe last time was talking about, these regional trade agreements that make things okay if you're in the agreement and not so good if you're outside the agreement. So they often make fun that we don't know where anything is on a map as American students. So that there would be Europe. What would you guess? So that's the EU. What would you guess this is?
England,
Great Britain. What would you guess that is? Switzerland. Who said that? Switzerland. Exactly so. Switzerland is very proud of their neutrality. In a variety of areas, including political, including financial. Their banking system is private. They don't want to be intertwined with the EU. So we have those things that are, that's the EU, minus Great Britain, minus Switzerland, which was never there. There's another version of the map. The United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement took effect July 1st, 2020. It used to be called what? What was it before?
NAFTA,
thank you. So it used to be NAFTA. Oh, yeah, it's right there, probably on your page. It replaced the North America Free Trade Agreement. Though NAFTA is officially expired, governments and companies are still adjusting to the new rules, most notably the new labor provisions. The coronavirus may also complicate the implementation, as manufacturers will be adapting to new guidelines in the middle of a global economic crisis. Yay. And that there is another thing on a map you ought to be familiar with. That would be, that's a long way down there. That would be North America, including the countries in the agreement, Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. Europe's over that way. Also over in the Asian area, we have the Asian Free Trade Agreement, South Asia Free Trade Area, an agreement that created a free trade zone covering more than 1.8 billion people. In India, Pakistan, Nepal, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Bhutan, and the Maldives, and the East Asian Free Trade Agreement on Services, again, a common market among those groups of countries that allow them to freely trade in services. Yes, ma'am?
In the notes, it says 1.4 billion.
Well, apparently, since the notes, they've grown by 4 billion people. Make it 1.8. Hopefully, that's not a test question. But a lot of people over there. And they're over that neck of the woods if you're looking on a map. So trend three, global competition. Who are we up against? How might we compete in a global market if that's what we decided to do? Well, we're talking about big companies here. One approach is to get involved in a strategic alliance, okay? This is an agreement among two or more independent firms to cooperate for the purpose of achieving common goals in their two countries. For example, we know the name Cheerios, right? Everybody know Cheerios? But we don't associate it with Nestle's here, do we? Nestle's? Of course not. We think about it as being General Mills in the U.S. But Nestle's breakfast cereals are manufactured by Cereal Partners, which is a joint venture. This, of course, is in Europe. A joint venture between Nestle and General Mills. Cereal Partners is one of the U.K.'s leading cereal manufacturers and also makes many of the leading UK retailer brand cereals you know. You'll recognize many of our well-known brands like Shredded Wheat, yeah, Shreddies, not so much, and Cheerios. So rather than go up into a foreign country, pour into General Mills, and try to battle to get brand name recognition there against existing competition, they say, wait a minute, what? You guys are already there. How about if you just market our product for us? And I'm sure there's something reciprocal. They're probably doing something for that group of companies over here. So strategic alliances. Another approach is to be what's called an international firm. In this case, we do international marketing pretty much the same way as we do it domestically. This has to work for the market, right? So whether it's a product or a labeling or coloration or taste or jingle, it has to work pretty well. So Belron is a vehicle glass repair and replacement group. They operate in 34 countries around the world. I don't know, see if any of these jingles sound familiar as we hear from different parts of the world.
Carglass repara, Carglass sustituisce. Auto glass repair, auto glass replace. Carglass repara, Carglass remplace. Carglass repariert, Carglass tauscht aus. Carglass επίση και βάζει Carglass αντικαρτιστά.
So, it might sound familiar. One sec, I'll be with you.
Safe Light Repair, Safe Light Replace.
What makes a Safe Light Repair different? We're so, always there.
Yes, thank you. So, they use pretty much the same jingle-ish, sounds like it was some differentiation, to market throughout all these countries of the world. It seems to work for them, yeah? So you might see them as an international firm, doing marketing the same way internationally as they do domestically. A multinational firm would be another approach to global competition where you have a multi-domestic marketing strategy. That is, you vary the marketing mix in each country that you're in. So whatever strategy you would use for those things we discussed wouldn't work well in different countries of the world. We all know Nestle's. Nestle's has many, many, many brands, and they operate many of their brands differently in different parts of the world, such that we wouldn't even know some of their brand names because they aren't done in our part of the world. Let's see if we know some of these that they would have. So we know Gerber. I don't know. Do we know Cerelac? Do we know Nido? Possibly not. So here in America, we know Gerber. We don't know Nido, arguably, because they aren't doing that branding here. They do different things in different parts of the world based on their needs. Do they have They have some pretty funny side dishes. But I don't think I'm going to see what I want here. Oh, yeah. So Maggi, we know Maggi. You might see that somewhere in the States. But I don't think you're seeing Mezeast and maybe not Tomy. All right, so they're varying the marketing mix in each of their countries. So this is a bit of their organization chart. Anybody know where they're headquartered, Nestle's? Solon regionally. How about their global corporate headquarters? Switzerland. Where in Switzerland? That's okay. Vevey, a little train ride out from Geneva, Vevey, Switzerland. So now there, they have, at the corporate level, product positioning, branding and logo, packaging and pricing. But then they drive to those different international markets, advertising, channel distribution in the U.S., in France, in Italy, Germany, et cetera, throughout their countries of the world. So that's their approach. Transnational firms use a global marketing strategy to standardize the marketing mix where there are cultural similarities, and then change the marketing mix where the cultures differ. So if we can make some of these things be the same as much as possible across countries, it's efficiencies, economies of scale, of production, research can go faster, rather than having to do something different in every country in the world. And in some cases, we'll change it where we have to, because whatever we're doing doesn't work. A goal of transnational firms is to create and maintain a balanced portfolio of global and local brands too. Take advantages of economies of scale where possible by sharing R&D, technical features, manufacturing across the brands. Grow global brands where they can, and then obtain market penetration through brand differentiation locally when it's necessary. Anybody know Henkel for any reason? They do marketing in the States as well as other places. It's a German company. The business is in 125 countries. They employ more than 50,000 people. They market more than 10,000 products across different market segments. They do laundry and home care. They do cosmetics and toiletries. And they do adhesives and technologies. So there's their little house, laundry, cosmetics, adhesives. And let's take a peek into one of their areas of competence. That's just a little story about how they were in the U.S., started in Scottsdale, Arizona, and then moved to another area, Stamford, Connecticut. All right, so let's look into their laundry and home care products strategic business unit. They compete with Procter & Gamble and Lever Brothers globally. They compete with multinational firms like Benckiser, and then they themselves are transnational. Now let's look within that. The hand dishwashing liquid category, squeeze, wash a dish, you know what I'm saying? There's 90% or more penetration of hand dishwashing soap in Western countries. So it's a huge market. On the one hand, it's a simple product, but it turns out that consumer habits do differ somewhat from country to country. And of course, all the players are battling for market share in the hand dishwasher category. So Henkel gets in, they buy a bunch of different products, and they're head scratching on how to market them globally. So on the left-hand side, they could do complete standardization. Everything would be the same across all the countries. They'd have low production costs because the more you manufacture the same thing, the lower the production cost per unit gets. Low complexity, whatever they change, it's only one thing because it's the same everywhere. And it would be very fast to roll out concepts because, again, same everywhere. Problem? Not everybody wants the same thing from you. At the other end, they could do complete differentiation. Everything's different in every country. They'd be close to the consumer. They'd be very flexible locally in responses to changes in the market, and they'd get good regional market penetration. However, what they choose to do is to merge the two, to be global where they can, local where they have to, which is, of course, the idea of glocalization. A marketing strategy is global, but the implementation at the marketing tactics level is done locally as needed, glocalization. So they chose glocal as their strategy. So here we see a series of brands that they bought, acquired, in the dishwashing liquid category. Pril, Per spelled a different way, Pril a different way, Her, Mistal, and something else I can't read. And you can see all different colors, all different bottles, different caps, and who knows what's inside the thing. It's crazy expensive to make all those different bottles and all those different caps and all those different colors and all those different names. Why do the consumers care, is the question on the floor. Or can we globalize some of that? So they do some research, and they said, well, the brand name, they're used to different things in different countries. We'll have to do a little localization. We'll differentiate there. The subname, whatever it says under the brand name, also different. But the basic concept of dishwashing liquid, pretty basic stuff. That's the same everywhere. The payoff, the positioning, the communication, pretty much the same. For some reason, product texture choices are different. Maybe some people like it to feel a little gritty, some people a little silky smooth, I don't know, some thicker. Then they decided, as you can see in this second set, that they could pretty much customize or standardize the bottle shape, the look of the logo, the lettering. For some reason, people in different countries wanted different caps, okay? The background, the key visual, and for some reason, at least in one country, they wanted their dishwashing liquid to be green instead of whatever color it is, blue. And so we can see that they had a convergence of different national brands into a Euro brand that, where necessary, respected the localities and updated. I don't remember what my update was. So, obviously, an article from Henkel. With such diverse offerings, Pril brand name is now a choice in many countries, such as Austria, Germany, Turkey, Egypt, and Algeria. In some markets, such as Italy, Turkey, and the GCC states, the brand Pril is also well established as a leading automatic dishwashing brand with an innovatively high-performing portfolio comprising of tabs as well as liquids and additives. All right, just a more detail on that product category. GM, obviously a global marketer. I think the story here is going to be a little bit dated, but let's think a little bit about GM dealing with global marketing. China, central to GM's global strategy. In 2010, GM sold more cars and trucks in China than in the U.S. 2017 was the sixth consecutive year that China was GM's top market. 2019, GM launched more than 20 new and refreshed models in China. It delivered more than 3 million vehicles, and Cadillac sales reached an all-time high of 213,000 units. GM's April 2020 sales in China rebounded, rising 13.6%. New vehicle sales were down markedly in the U.S. in 2020. In April, as much as 50% in some cases. However, GM sales in China are the flip side of the coin, rising 13.6% in that month. That's one reason to go global. Things are crashing at home, but maybe they're going great guns overseas or vice versa. So you're able to balance what's going on in the world. So if we're going global, we've got to know a bunch of stuff. We've got to scan the environment to know what we're getting into. What are the differences in these other parts of the world when it comes to the social and cultural environment? For example, are families large or small? Does dad run the family? Does mom? How important are kids in the family in this country? That would influence, of course, your message for cereal, toys, clothes, McDonald's. What about their tastes and their customs and their behaviors? We've already, I think, touched on the idea of how do you interact with other people in person? Is it shake, kiss, bow, hug? What do you do? And there was one commercial groups of businessmen coming together from Japan and the U.S., and no one knew what they were going to do next. Were they going to bow to each other? Were they going to handshake so they keep going like this as they're trying to figure out what they're doing? What's it mean for your commercial? What's it mean for your sales force? How are you going to interact? When Kentucky Fried Chicken, an early mover, went to Japan so many years ago, they discovered right away that their coleslaw was too sweet. People didn't mind coleslaw, but it was way too sweet. A no-brainer to fix that problem once they discovered it was to cut down on the sweetness, yeah? They also discovered that in Asian markets, including in Japan, customers want to see what the product looks like outside the store. Have you ever been maybe to a Japanese or Chinese restaurant and they actually have displays in the U.S. of what some of the food looks like? No? Molds, displays? Well, they had to do that stuff as well. So there it is. Kiss, bow, or shake hands. What are we going to do? Education. What's the education level of the country? If you are illiterate, does illiterate mean you're stupid? What does illiterate mean?
Can't read.
Not uneducated, but you can't read. It's a specific difference. So you can't read, but you're still a consumer. You still have money. You're still going to go shopping. You're still going to go to the store. You just can't read. If you can't read, how do you know what's in the package you're about to buy? Say again? The pictures, right? The pictures tell you what you're going to buy. So we have a situation where Gerber, baby food, decides to go into Africa where many of the villagers buy products, but they are illiterate. They can't read. They're not stupid, but they can't read. So they read the baby food packages, and what did they assume was inside the jars? Ground up baby. It was not a big seller, as you might imagine. Because that's what the package told them. They might have thought that went through a little more deeply. Obviously, they had to change the strategy for this particular product category. Ground-up babies, while tasty, are not what was in the jar. So what language, of course, are you using as well? Translate it over, cross-translate it back, make sure it means whatever you think it's going to mean. What are some impediments to understanding foreign markets? Well, one impediment is something called the self-reference criteria. This is an unconscious reference to your own values, experiences, and knowledge as a basis for making business decisions. So you don't even think to ask about these things. You just do it because this is what we do. Baby food goes in baby food jars with pictures of baby food on them. Boom. not, but you didn't think it through. So that obviously impedes international trade. Self-reference criteria can result in a failure to develop an open attitude and a cultural sensitivity that would enable managers to look carefully at the foreign market and to understand the customer's needs in that foreign market and not simply transfer the needs of the domestic market into that foreign market. You would think we could train people working in international to be aware of that, but these mistakes happen all the time, yeah? A little worse is ethnocentrism. Ethnocentrism isn't being sort of unaware of the whole thing. It's a little worse because it's your belief that your culture is superior to the other cultures. You're going to go over there and tell them what's what and how things are done, and they should do it like Americans do it. That's hardly ever a way to guarantee success as you go to get consumers in another part of the world, but it's also an impediment to doing business. Walmart attempted to implement its successful strategies in Japan, including its everyday low prices. Who thinks that sounds stupid? Everyday low prices in Japan? You're saying it does sound stupid? What? Unless you've already read the answer, why? Oh, you're scratching your head. Do you have an opinion? Okay. So it doesn't seem like the stupidest thing ever, but it doesn't have the same value in Japan as it does in the United States because Japanese consumers associate low prices with cheap quality. And it makes them worry about shopping at a place that has everyday low prices. Their local operations were struggling. They're closing stores because the idea doesn't work there. Works here just fine. Why won't it work there? Different values, folks. Nike released a set of women's sports gear inspired by traditional tattoos from the Southwest Pacific. But the international sports brand made a cultural faux pas and ended up pooling the product. The women's leggings created the appearance that the world had a traditional Samoan tattoo, the pei, which is reserved for men. They didn't take the time to consult with those in the know, people from that culture. A blogger on one Samoan Facebook page called the Nike's use of the tatau an ugly exploitation of culture. Another noted, to the outside world, it's just a design, but to my Polynesian people, it's sacred. Let's not put sacred emblems of our customer market on our sports gear. not thoughtful. We also want to know about the economic environment. For example, the infrastructure. Does the country have the ability to provide the communications you need, both for your stores and to your consumers? The transportation you need for your products among your stores, warehouses, to your consumers? The energy that you need to do manufacturing, etc. What about the level of economic development in that area you're thinking about going into? It's a general indicator of the market's attractiveness, and it's an indicator of the types of products that will likely be in demand. In the U.S., even though we're seeing a great divide, there's still a fairly small, extremely wealthy class, a pretty good size, although there's a bit of a divide, middle class, and then a smaller class that verges on poverty. What's that mean? Well, there's a huge market for things like underarm deodorants, air conditioners, fans, pop culture things. That middle class has a lot of money. They buy that sort of stuff. Is there also markets for really, you know, dollar stores and less sorts of things? Well, yeah. It's not the main market, but it's there. What about for jet airplanes and yachts? Yeah, but that's like the top couple percent. Tells you something about the market. There are places in the world that have a small, really wealthy group at the very top, almost no middle class, and everybody else is at the bottom. What's it mean for your marketing? Well, there's probably not a huge demand for air conditioners, fans, and underarm deodorant. They have agricultural products and that sort of need, sustenance stuff. And then there's a small market for the yachts and the jet planes at the top, yeah? So what is the economic picture of the place you're going into? The gross national income per capita would be useful information to know as you think about going into a country. Here's the rate of change of real gross domestic product in Japan, the U.S., the United Kingdom, and China. As you can see, 2020 was not a good year anywhere, but the United Kingdom really took it on the chin. China, while down, hadn't gone negative as of 2020. What's going on in your part of the world you're thinking about going into? Coronavirus wreaked havoc on economic growth prospects. Compared to its January 2020 projection, the World Bank revised its global growth estimate by 7.7 percentage points, with the euro area and Brazil suffering the biggest hit to their economic growth prospects. Things not looking good. Competition in that area you're thinking about going into. Obviously, we mentioned this earlier, like last time, they've been doing quite well without you till now. Local competition is okay. Are you doing something better? So you've got to have some differential advantage over the local brands. KFC went great guns in Japan, in China, as we'll see in a little bit. They were providing a valued product. Starbucks, we mentioned Italy last time, apparently not providing much value locally, although they're big in other places like France. Political stability. When the country's not politically stable, you risk losses. You've invested in your own manufacturing plant, in your own sales group, or in a partner there, and the whole country clashes in on you. Not so good. You might have checked the political stability. Here is the political stability from strong through weak in 2018. I don't know that much about Liechtenstein, but apparently it's very politically stable. Moving down to Switzerland, still pretty stable. In the middle groups, we have, among other things, the USA in 2018. And then I'm suggesting you don't take serious consideration of Libya, Somalia, Iraq, Yemen, Afghanistan, or Syria for your next manufacturing plant. Not a good idea. Just a visual image for those that like colorful things, where things are looking pretty good, into the blues and the greens, and pretty bad into the yellows and the reds. Yeah, more of the same. Just ways to think about the environment that you're going into. How will you do this? How will you enter this foreign country? Are you going to just dip a toe in? Are you going to be heavily involved in it? One approach is indirect exporting. You don't want anything to do with it, frankly. You're not going to mess with it. But you don't mind somebody else buying your product, a third party, and selling it somewhere. I don't know what your warranty looks like. I don't know what your customer support looks like because they're selling it in some other country. But you are technically an indirect exporter. Direct exporting, you don't have a lot of stuff invested in that foreign country. Maybe you have a desk in the corner and you say, okay, you go start phoning countries and see if you can get some distribution for us, for example. So direct exporting. Licensing, you might hire and pay a manufacturer in that country to make your product under your specs. Obviously, they have confidentiality. They aren't supposed to steal your intellectual property, China. And so you do that. Why? Because perhaps in that economic zone, like, say, the EU, if you're manufacturing there, you don't have to pay taxes, tariffs, whatever it might be. Contract assembly. You ship the pieces and parts there. They put it together in that country. Franchising, a form of licensing we're well familiar with. Joint venture, you work intimately with another company. And direct investment. So here on the left-hand side, we see exporting directly or through import-export middlemen indirectly. Low involvement, also low risk. Country crashes, you don't have anybody there. You don't really care. Low control, they do what they want to do. Not much money. Moving over a bit, you could have company sales branches over there. Your salespeople are selling product. You could license your product to foreign producers. You could do contract manufacturing by foreign producers, joint ventures, wholly owned subsidiaries, and be a multinational corporation. So we said last time, I think, that Ohio is one of the top 10 exporting states in the country. So looks like right now it is 7 out of 50 states in terms of export, 11 out of 50 in terms of import, and they have a balance of trade balance rank of 38. This is why I say when we talked about is protectionism good, it just closes in your market. Ohio is 7th out of 50 in exporting goods to other countries, business, revenue, and 11th out of 50 in importing, business, and revenue. And if you want to get involved in export, but it seems a little bit of a puzzle, here you can actually go to the Ohio Department of Development and learn how you might get involved in doing export. I was actually one time I went to a trade show up here in, I think it was the Sheridan Suites in Cuyahoga Falls, and they had a bunch of people there, and there was a company there from Medina. They were manufacturing garage doors. I said, garage doors, why are you at an export fair? He said, I don't really have a good explanation, but Europe loves our garage doors. We export garage doors to Europe. I don't know if they're still doing it, but that was sort of an interesting little local story. So if you want help, I think it's probably going to take us to a similar site, which you can actually get help in. There you go, same thing. Exporting. Coca-Cola does either licensing foreign producers to make their product or contract manufacturing by foreign producers of their super secret formula, as do other beverage companies. GM has joint ventures and strategic alliances throughout different parts of the world. General Motors is a global company committed to delivering safer, better, and more sustainable ways for people to get around. GM, its subsidiaries, and its joint ventures sell vehicles under the Chevrolet, Buick, GMC, Cadillac, Baojun, and Wuling brands. Did you know that that was part of GM? More information on the company's subsidiaries, including OnStar, a global leader in the vehicle safety and security services, can be found at www.gm.com. GM's joint ventures in China have more than 58,000 employees. Along with its joint ventures, GM offers the broadest lineup of vehicles and brands among automakers in China. Products are sold under the Buick, Cadillac, Chevrolet, Baojun, and Wuling nameplates. Who knew? They're obviously heavily invested there. And a multinational corporation, Saint-Gobain. Anybody that recognize the icon, the image up there, the little roof thing, or the name Saint-Gobain? You do? Yeah, they're actually around. Or are we just scratching? So they're around here. So let's look at a couple of these guys. Coca-Cola, licensing contract manufacturing by foreign producers, based in Atlanta, Georgia, operates in 200 companies, so they're pretty widespread. They use over 300 bottling partners with exclusive rights, so if you're a Coca-Cola manufacturer, you can't decide to suddenly go make Pepsi-Cola. That's not part of the deal. And they deal with 50 different currencies. Some are up, some are down. Domestic problems. So this was a while ago in the last recession. Domestic economic problems in the last recession meant at that time the U.S. dollar was weaker in the world. The dollar lost at that time 3.4% against the euro and 1% against the Japanese yen. So U.S. consumers had to pay more for imported goods, but for Coke, the weakness in some currencies were offset by strengths in other currencies. In the second quarter of this recession, Coke reported a 20% increase in income, and 11% of their 20% increase in income was due to foreign exchange rates, people playing around with money in different countries of the world. So as a global company, Coke has distributed its risks throughout the world. This talks a little bit about the strategic alliance and joint ventures for GM. Global strategic alliances are typically set up when a business desires to edge into a related business or a new geographic market. If an organization doesn't have the capability to do what they want to or need to do in coping with their global environment, they should think about a global business partnership alliance. Getting into the distribution network in China is tough, also Japan. It's hard to do. So what about partnering up with somebody who's already there? SAIC General Motors Corporation Limited, more commonly known as SAIC GM Chinese, is a joint venture between GM Company and SAIC Motors that manufactures and sells all those brands we talked about. And I don't remember where my link takes me. Probably to this page. Not so exciting. Saint-Gobain, a multinational company, more than 1,000 companies at your service. Saint-Gobain is present in 54 countries, listed on the stock markets in Paris, London, Frankfurt, Zurich, Brussels, and Amsterdam. One of the world's 100 leading industrial corporations, has a workforce of over 200,000 people. You'd think we'd have heard of it. They produce, process, and distribute glass, ceramics, plastics, cast iron, etc. They transform raw materials into advanced properties for use in our daily lives, and they develop tomorrow's new materials. Saint-Gobain specializes in the design, production, and distribution of functional materials, including glass, for the automotive and construction industries and those other products. So I was in, I have said I took students over to Europe for a long time. We went to the corporate headquarters for Saint-Domingue, which was outside of Paris in a place called La Défense. And so we're visiting there, and they had a relatively new HR person. So she came over to chat with our group of students. And she said, where are you from again? I said, Kent State. She said, and where's that? I said, Kent, Ohio. She says, this lady is HR for a global, she said, I was just there. Why were you just there? She has a new HR person. She was visiting some of their various distributed companies. They had a place down here in Ravenna, maybe one in Solon. She was just through Kent. It's a crazy world. So here's some of the places last time I checked where they have local connections with us. Saint-Gobain Performance Plastics in Solon, Saint-Gobain Aerospace in Ravenna, Saint-Gobain Crystals in Hiram, and again, one of their logos at the bottom. Lots and lots of other places where they have local connections because they're a multinational company with connections in the U.S. How will we deal with our marketing mix in these foreign countries? So let's think about one of the P's, the product. One approach is just to do what's called a product extension. We'll sell the same product there we're selling here. I'm trying to think of a really good example. Maybe at the baseline product for McDonald's hamburgers. Other things in the menu may change, but I think the burger is pretty much the burger. I don't know about in India. I have to think about that where they don't do beef. Or product adaptation, modification. We would change the product to match the consumer's differing needs, wants, and desires in that particular country. In the U.S., of course, Coca-Cola uses artificial sweeteners, corn syrup. In some parts of the world, they use actual sugar to sweeten their product. It tastes a little different in some parts of the world. Product invention. We're going to create an entirely new product to satisfy the needs, wants, and desires that aren't being met by any current product in that country, part of the world. You can see the difference in risk, eh? Selling a product you know very well, selling one that's changed a little bit, selling one that's brand new, moves from hardly any risk to a lot of risk as you decide to try to satisfy, as you try to grow. This little story about McDonald's going into China, we'll see in the background a little bit about KFC, who's been out for a little while. Let's hear a little bit about them, and we'll see a bit about the four P's of the marketing mix that they deal with. Any questions on that?
Inside the McDonald's empire.
Same hamburgers, same fries, same drinks. You might think you're in Dallas or Detroit, but this is China. 2 decades ago, McDonald's was largely unknown here, except as a symbol of the decadent West. But a capitalist revolution has swept through the People's Republic. And today, mainland China, still officially communist, is home to 800 McDonald's restaurants, with 200 more in Hong Kong.
And means I'm loving it.
Jeff Schwartz is loving it too. He's CEO of McDonald's China.
When you look at the map, can you imagine how many stores might be in China one day?
I don't need to look at the map to imagine that. I just look at the 1.3 billion population. You know, easily we're talking 10,000 restaurants, 15,000 restaurants as it continues to develop. So the opportunity is endless.
Yeah. Endless, but not effortless. That's why Schwartz and his boss, Tim Fenton, spend so much time in China, on the road, in the air, and on the move.
3 weeks out of four.
Fenton is president of McDonald's for Asia, the Middle East, and Africa.
Wei Xiao.
There's no one at McDonald's with more experience moving into new markets.
Mistakes we've made in the past, you don't open just one store. You get three or four or five deals done, build them consecutively, train the crew consecutively, so you save on the money. So when a truck goes out from the distribution center, it's not carrying one store. It's carrying the products for 3 to 5.
When McDonald's first opened in China in 1990, these streets were clogged with bicycles. But prosperity's brought an explosion in car ownership. However many headaches that may mean for Chinese drivers, McDonald's saw an opportunity called drive-thru.
Hi. Well, this is the very first drive-thru. We opened in November of 2005, so it's been about 18 months. Very, very successful.
First drive-thru, not just for the company.
For anywhere in China. So anywhere at all in China. So drive-thru was a brand new concept anywhere in China.
In fact, drive-thru was such a new concept in 2005 that many Chinese didn't know how to use it.
We have a lot of traffic, and I'm walking around, they pick up the food, and then they went in the, and then they went in and parked their car, they brought the bag of food, and they went inside. And I watched this happen several times, and I said, I think we might have a problem here on how the Chinese use the drive-thru.
Which meant that Chinese crews not only had to learn how to run a drive-thru, but had to teach their customers how to use one.
They're very good about holding their hands out, that, you know, stop here. Is this something that you train your crew?
Train her crew to greet customer with the hand out of the window. This way they will train their customer how to use drive-thru.
But still, some customers don't catch on as fast as others.
Well, he's coming in the exit side,
yeah.
This BMW here. That's part of the training sometimes about with a drive-thru.
Yeah.
McDonald's is up to 26 drive-thrus in China so far. But if most Chinese drivers still aren't familiar with the idea, that's about to change dramatically. In 2006, McDonald's signed an agreement with the Chinese state oil company, Sinopec, granting it the right to open McDonald's stores at any of Sinopec's new and existing gas stations, 30,000 of them. The very first one, opened in July of 2006, is this store. In a surprisingly run-down neighborhood outside Beijing.
Obviously, it's on the fringe, okay? It's off the beaten path of main, you know, Beijing. So it's a suburb coming out.
It's a little grittier.
Yeah, it's a little grittier, but it's like an oasis to me. I'm guessing we might be a little premature here.
Yeah.
From the McDonald's side,
yeah.
But with only upside potential.
Yeah.
That, in a nutshell, has become a key part of McDonald's expansion strategy in China. The willingness to bet on an area that may not be ready for McDonald's yet. But with China the world's fastest growing economy, McDonald's is banking on neighborhoods like this being a good gamble.
It's really not that difficult. You look at a developing area, you see where it's going. You see the corners, you see the retail, you see the apartments and the condos coming in.
You can spot an up-and-comer.
Yeah,
in
we've done a lot of real estate. we've done it like 34,000 times.
Tell me about what this neighborhood looked like before this store was built.
Nothing was around. These buildings right here were half built, and there was nothing behind there. But you looked at the site layout, and they said, well, the shopping mall's going here. There's going to be, you know, 5,000 residents here, and down the street here will be another 5,000 residents. It was amazing.
But for all of China's potential, the learning curve for McDonald's here has been steep, and they've had to play catch-up. When McDonald's opened its first mainland store in 1990, rival KFC had already been there for 3 years. Today, there are more than 1,900 KFC stores in China, more than twice as many as the Golden Arches. McDonald's has a lot of competition here in China, not all of it from big-name U.S. brands like KFC. You can find mom-and-pop food stands like these all over the country. And although dishes like scorpions and seahorses on a stick may not be your idea of a meal, here they're traditional, they're convenient, and they're cheap. A short walk through any Chinese city reveals a kaleidoscopic array of foods, tastes, and textures. Adapting the McDonald's menu to palates used to foods like these is the job of McDonald's corporate chef, Leslie Bailey.
Now, this is the value pork burger.
He spends his days in a Hong Kong food lab that McDonald's calls the Forbidden Kitchen.
We're going to test this in 40 stores.
This has a good fit to it.
What makes it hot? Is it the sauce or the patty?
No, the patty itself. It's seasoned with Sichuan pepper.
That is good.
Yeah?
That is a good sandwich.
With the cucumber.
Wow.
Taste, convenience, and price are important in China, just like in the U.S. But the issue here that trumps them all is food safety. It is a nightmarish problem in a developing country where corruption is rampant and safe food handling practices are still largely unknown.
How much do you live in fear of waking up some morning and seeing a headline about McDonald's food safety being called into question?
I don't live in fear of it. It's always in the back of your mind, something because of the area we live in, particularly of the history that this part of the world has had with avian influenza and SARS.
Food safety concerns are one reason all Chinese McDonald's stores have hand washing stations and hand sanitizers right out in the main restaurant. And behind the scenes, McDonald's says its stores and its Chinese suppliers, like this bun factory near Beijing, meet the same standards as those in the U.S.
So we see some advantage to being an early mover. KFC had twice the amount of stores in China by the time McDonald's moved in because they were among the first to move into Japan. They had that experience. We don't see all the elements of the marketing mix, but we certainly see some stuff going on with the adaptation of products. And we see some of the stuff going on with place distribution and a bit about channels of distribution as you learn lessons in another country. One day, I don't think I bothered updating it here, but one day I have to go and see how many stores there are today. I haven't updated to see what happened. This is sadly amusing. He's talking about China and its issue with SARS and the avian flu. And in the early 2000s, they had sanitizers in their stores, foreshadowing 2020, I guess. But they've been quite successful there. Sometimes, has anybody been to Japan to a KFC there for any reason? Sometimes we get... In China, and oh, in China, I don't mind in China. What I'm saying is, in Japan, I'm told, it's like the place you go, adults for birthdays and celebrations and I don't know holidays. You go to a KFC.
I actually had a layover in Japan.
Yeah.
That's going over there. That's actually kind of the joke.
The joke?
That's kind of the common. Like, for us, it's like KFC. Just
yeah, yeah, but it's fancy there. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you never know. How are you going to play out in these other countries of the world? All right, so promotion strategies. Are you going to use the same promotion globally? Are you going to adapt promotions to local taste? This is a Japanese ad for, I think, McDonald's. I don't think you'd see this one play for McDonald's in the U.S.
Grand, I'm loving it. Debut.
I don't know what that's all about. A little too sexy for us in the U.S., I think, for ads. Create entirely new promotions as appropriate for the local situation. So we bring all this together and we think about the product and promotion strategies for global marketing. Same promotion, same product. You're just using a product extension strategy to grow. A same promotion. And a product adaptation, you're going to, adapting product, use a product adaptation strategy. If you're using the same product and adapting the promotion, then you have a communication adaptation strategy. If you have a new product, if you're adapting the product and your promotion, a dual adaptation strategy. And then if you're creating an entirely new product, you have a product invention strategy. You have to decide what's right for you, given all your research, all your understanding of the consumers, your product, the competition, what's going to work for you. You have to think about the fact that the channels of distribution are going to be quite long and complex. We certainly learned that lesson most recently with our channels of distribution. But you're used to working maybe with distributors in the U.S., and now you're going to go to China, Japan, Europe. How's product going back and forth? How long is it going to take? What are you thinking about that sort of planning? Countries may impose pricing restraints. We talked about trade restrictions last time, how would that influence your pricing as you go to market in that country. Dan Muller over at Timken ran into an interesting cultural difference in how their clients think about pricing that he had to deal with, and it came as a little bit of a surprise to his folks.
We tend to hire locals, and if you know, our business in China, we're hiring China. Citizens, and so they understand the culture pretty well. Our marketing communications people are Chinese, so we tend to do pretty well, I think, in terms of promotion and marketing. The one example, though, I thought of was in pricing, because one of the things that happened over the last 3 or 4 years is certain lines of our products, we had more demand in the marketplace than we could produce. And that's a nice problem to have, although you have upset customers that can't get enough product. And so we actually were talking to our sales organization about the importance of pricing. You know, you're in an environment where there's not enough product to go around. There are some customers willing to pay more to get more product. And so this pricing discussion was very important. And so with our raw material cost increases we've seen in steel and energy and all those kinds of things, price increases have been a big topic. We have to do it to survive. And we're also in the situation where demand exceeds supply for some products. And so one of the things we encountered in China is we had some salespeople that were very hesitant to do that. And I think in some of the Asian cultures, to go to a customer and communicate to them a price increase was losing face. And we didn't understand that when we talked to our sales team about that, and the feedback started to come back. And so we had to kind of go back a second time and just have an open discussion about why this was so important and how to communicate it to the customer in a way where you didn't lose face with the customer, that the customer can understand this is something we have to do so that we can continue to service you with high-quality products and services. So that was an interesting one that happened in China.
So in China in particular, some Asian cultures in general, you do business with people based on respect for one another. You have to have somewhat equal status in your relationship. And to mess that up is to lose your status, to lose your respect, loss of face. Is that a familiar loss of face? Is that a term you know? So loss of face is a bad thing in these relationships. And so to go back on this partner, your client, and say, hey, we had an agreed price, but we're changing the dealio, was not an easy thing for these folks to do. In the U.S., we understand that. It's going on with us right now in many areas. There it was not. And we didn't understand that it would be a problem. And so we had to go over there and rethink how we were going to communicate this to our through our Chinese sales force to our Chinese clients. Interested in knowing more, we have an international business for business majors. I guess it's international minor. Or we have international business for non-business majors. Or if you just want a course or two, we have international business as a course and international marketing. Also, there are training videos out there in the world if you're interested in those. So there's lots of stuff if you want to know more about going global. All of this, I keep referring to the need to get research to understand the consumer, whether we're talking about domestically or internationally, which takes us to the idea of doing marketing research to understand the consumer and doing it to create action plans. And that takes us into Chapter 8, Marketing Research, From Consumer Insights to Actions, Lectures Note page 144. So we've already chatted about some of the stuff we really have to do research on. The CREST factors, those environmental factors outside the organization that impact our consumers, impact our business, and therefore our marketing, and the four pieces of the marketing mix. So we have the CREST factors. C is? Competition. Is it already there? R is?
Regulatory legal.
It's already on the page. E is? S? And T. Be good to remember some of those on your own sometime. All right. So we have to understand these factors, which means we've got to research them, follow the trends, ask what it means for our consumers, and what it's going to mean for our business. Marketing research helps us to do that. Whether we're talking about the impact on the industrial consumer or on the ultimate consumer, either way, it's going to impact what's going on in our market for our customers, and so we'll arguably influence our marketing mix. So here we are back to our strategic framework for marketing. We're thinking about all of those environmental factors and doing research on them and asking ourselves what it's going to mean for our customer because it's going to influence the rest of our process. So what is marketing research? It's the process of defining a marketing problem and a marketing opportunity and then systematically collecting and analyzing information. And finally, based on what we've learned, given our problem and opportunity, recommending actions Research is imperfect. But I got to tell you, if my company's future revenue, future success, profitability, and maybe my job depends on making a decision, sure, I'd like to use some of my 20, 30, 40 years of experience in the business, yes. But even though marketing research might not be, I'd like to know what marketing research says too. You run your life your way. I'd like some more data. I can choose to ignore the data, but what does it say? So of course it's not perfect. We have to know that. But what does it tell us? What does it say? So we recognize it's imperfect. Alex Schaefer, the Senior Manager of Consumer Insights at Dollar Shave Club. How many of you guys know Dollar Shave Club? I've heard of it, yeah? Works with Prodigy. We've heard from our young lad at Prodigy to do marketing research. The research guides product innovation, communication strategy, and brand positioning through insights projects that ensures the consumer is at the center of business decision-making and strategy. Alex's passion for research stems from his interest in uncovering human motivations. We've talked about that. We talked about understanding consumer behavior. And he says at its core, research is about understanding people on a human level. Why do they do what they do? How do they feel when they do certain things? And from a business perspective, how a brand or a product can play a meaningful role in their lives. Furthermore, what research reminds me to do on a daily basis is to practice empathy. While we all practice empathy daily, I love that it's a crucial part of my work, and that the more I empathize with the people I'm talking to or surveying, my customers, the better insights I'm able to deliver. The most successful and impactful research I've done has helped decision makers to put themselves in the shoes of the consumers and build strategy from that point. Whoever thought about marketing research as being empathy with your customers and helping you to understand them better to drive action? So here's marketing research for planning our marketing programs as we better understand our consumers and the value we deliver to them. We use it in implementing our programs to make sure that things are going as they should and measure how they are going. And in the evaluation of the programs, how well did things go? Were they on target or not? Did we hit our key performance indicators? Were we successful reaching our goals? And marketing researchers are responsible for collecting and interpreting data that supports all this decision making, just as we heard a second ago. Doesn't always work. I got 3 minutes and then I'll wrap it up. You may have by now have heard the old story of New Coke. Coke and Pepsi were in a battle. Coke was beginning to lose the battle. Coke does blind taste tests on a new product called New Coke. In blind taste tests, when people didn't know what they were tasting, they preferred New Coke to Old Coke, and they preferred New Coke to Pepsi. They killed Old Coke and rolled out New Coke. People went berserk. What do you mean you're getting rid of Coke? It's my Coke. I grew up with that Coke. People were boycotting them, pounding on the corporate gates. They missed a little bit of the emotional connection people had with classic Coke. Crystal Pepsi was the idea that people really needed a totally clear water-looking Pepsi that when you drank it, tasted exactly like Pepsi. The product's dead, but they rolled out periodically for nostalgia's sake. And when you drink it, your brain goes, what? Because it looks like you're drinking water, but it's Pepsi. Nobody wanted that. Starbucks partners with Pepsi to sell Mazagran, a coffee-flavored bottled soda, a spectacular failure described at best as interesting. And finally, I'll let you go, Colgate. What do you think of when you think Colgate? Toothpaste, not a kitchen entree. Field research, field product. Okay, end of the material for mini test, whatever we're on. Six, I guess, I think. And I'll post the information for you. Ta-ta.